This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Japanese women are known for having tiny waistlines, and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton and I'm coming to you live from our studio in central London. We begin this hour with the global fallout we're seeing following Friday's fireworks in the Oval Office, a very public confrontation between the US president and his Ukrainian counterpart, two men who were supposed to be allies. President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance sat down on Friday with visiting President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine to discuss peace in Ukraine. It was meant to be a brief chat in front of journalists before signing a pre-agreed mineral deal. Instead, the conversation, which was playing out on live TV, quickly degenerated into a verbal boxing match. Mr. Trump and Mr. Vance castigated Mr. Zelensky for not being grateful enough for U.S. support in its war with Russia. Donald Trump became visibly furious, shaking his finger at the Ukrainian leader.
You're gambling with World War III, and what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
In this entire meeting, you said thank you. You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Please, you think that if you will speak very loudly about the war, you
can... He's not speaking loudly.
We are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks
in
this cabinet.
You haven't been alone. We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted
for your
president.
We gave you military equipment, and your men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about us?
If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
maybe less.
In 2 weeks. Of course, yeah.
You don't have the cards.
I'm thankful.
You're buried there. Your people are dying.
I can tell you.
You're running low on soldiers. Listen.
Don't, please.
You're running low on soldiers. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out.
Confrontation continued for quite some time, and shortly after, the Ukrainian leader was asked to leave the White House by senior Trump officials. The mineral deal was put on hold, and a press conference was abruptly cancelled. Mr. Zelensky, speaking later on Fox News, said he thought the relationship could be salvaged.
I respect the president and I respect American people. I think maybe some things we have to discuss out of media, with all respect to democracy and to a free media. But there are things that where we have to understand the position of Ukraine and Ukrainians. A ceasefire without security guarantees, this is so sensitive for our people. I'm speaking like a president of a people who are in this struggle 3 years, and they just want to hear that America on our side and that America will stay with us, not with Russians, with us.
But in an interview with the U.S. television network CNN, Marco Rubio questioned whether the Ukrainian president really wanted a peace deal.
He turns to the vice president. What kind of diplomacy are you talking about? Almost as if to say, these people, you can't deal with them. You can't have any negotiations with Putin because he can't be trusted and you're just wasting your time on negotiations. Well, he's directly, basically undermining everything the president has told him he's trying to do. Look, there's no need for that. You start to suspect, does he really want an end to this war? Does he just think that, you know, we have to do whatever he says and give him anything he wants without any end game?
Democrats in the U.S. Congress have accused Mr. Trump of embarrassing America on the world stage. Speaking to my colleague Paul Henley, the Democratic congressman for Southern California, Brad Sherman, described what he thought had happened.
There was a trap, and I think he fell right into it. It's well known that J.D. Vance does not want to see us support Ukraine, and that Trump both doesn't like spending the money, but also doesn't see our vital interests involved. And the outcome was exactly what Trump and especially Vance wanted to see.
When you say that you think Mr. Zelensky fell into a trap, what should he have said when he was told he was being disrespectful?
It's now well known among world leaders that Trump likes leaders who are obsequious, and nothing in Zelensky's recent history equips him for that. He is the heroic leader of a surprisingly successful and heroic nation on its defense. He's treated very well everywhere he goes. And the obsequiousness that Trump thrives on is not his specialty.
Ina Sovsun is a Ukrainian MP with the opposition Golos Party. Speaking from Kyiv, she said she understood Mr. Zelensky's response to how he was treated in the Oval Office.
He stood up for Ukraine. He probably should have just taken a step back and not react when he was being directly attacked. But I do understand that it must have been very difficult for him. It was very difficult for me to watch because after everything we have been through, after all the terror that we have faced, you can't help yourself but try to protect our understanding of this situation. So he reacted as a human being. Probably in retrospect, you could say that he should have, you know, gave the chance to J.D. Vance to speak and then only then react.
And these ordinary Ukrainians in Kyiv said the process had been unpleasant to see.
You know, when you look at Zelensky's face, you understand that the discussion behind the closed doors was not so polite, because they are so rude. They don't respect people of Ukraine.
Maybe it was not a very diplomatic conversation, but it was very sincere. We're trying to tell about what's going on. Unfortunately, for some reason, President Trump has a bit of a wrong idea.
From the side, looks like they support Russia, and they ignore everything regarding the war in Ukraine, the Russian-Ukrainian war, and they think, like, okay, we can trade, we can deal, we can forget it, but we can.
Those voices from Kyiv. Well, Volodymyr Zelensky has now landed in London, and he's due to meet with the UK's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. European leaders will gather in London tomorrow to see what can be done to chart a way forward. Now, Alistair Campbell was the director of communications for the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and was present at many meetings of world leaders. I spoke to him and I asked him, where did all this go wrong?
It felt to me like a complete ambush. I think part of the problem is I've had lots of experience of these so-called pull sprays at the top. I've never understood why, when you have really serious, difficult, delicate meetings, they have these shambolic meetings with the media, bring them into the top of the meeting, shouting dozens of questions at the same time, the president picking out a few. If this were a serious meeting about a serious attempt at peace, you might have done a few pictures, you might have said a few words of welcome, great to see you, blah, blah, blah. Then you'd have gone on with the meeting. And then once it started to go wrong, if you were a serious diplomat, Trump would have said, OK, listen, these are things we should probably best talk about in private. So thanks for being here, the press. Now, you know, get out. Instead of which, he seemed to be reveling in it. The thing about saying at the end, this is great television, the saying the American people need to see this. J.D. Vance behaving like a kind of school playground bully. And I just hope that the meeting that Keir Starmer's hosting tomorrow in London, there's a really, really solid message from Europe about whose side we're on.
You said you think it felt like an ambush, but 24 hours before, when Keir Starmer was in the Oval Office,
that's when we saw Donald Trump sort of wave off words he'd said earlier, saying that Mr. Zelensky was a dictator. He seemed to indicate that he was really open to trying to get back the land that Russia had taken away from Ukraine. So we were getting a different message on Thursday than what we saw on Friday. Why do you think that this was an ambush then?
The first thing to say is that Donald Trump is so unreliable. One week he calls him a dictator. The next week he makes a joke about it. Did I really say that? Zelensky went into that meeting with the media present. Now, you could say that, you know, people have said Zelensky should have kept his cool. Just try and see it from his perspective. His country's being invaded. He's living 24/7 fighting for his own political and personal survival and his country's survival. He has a change of government in America, and the new guy never says a word of criticism of the invader and yet calls him a dictator. It's just inexcusable. But the thing that made me think it was an ambush was the role of Vance. J.D. Vance doesn't operate like Donald Trump, doesn't operate in the same way as Donald Trump. I've been in loads and loads and loads of meetings with presidents and with prime ministers. By and large, the number twos, the number threes, they stay quiet, particularly, as I say, when it's not even the proper meeting yet. And this is a guy who's on record as saying, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine. When you see that sort of situation develop, it's very hard to see it other than as deliberate. You've got people like Rubio and Lindsey Graham, who in the past have actually been pretty good at standing up to Putin, suddenly just sort of caving in and putting out these cut and paste tweets about how wonderful Trump is. The whole thing's about domestic politics. And I honestly feel America has elected a complete disaster and the rest of the world is having to pick up the pieces and live with the consequences.
Casting forward to Sunday, when European leaders are coming to London, Mr. Zelensky has already arrived in London for a meeting. How can Europe begin to pick up the pieces from all this?
Well, I think diplomatically, fairly straightforwardly, by being absolutely clear, as most of the European leaders already have been. I thought it was very interesting. I think the first major European leader I saw commenting on this was Friedrich Merz, the soon-to-be new Chancellor of Germany. So that will be very, very important, just making clear that, yeah, Europe maybe doesn't have the nuclear capacity that Russia does, and Europe doesn't have the kind of standing army that America does, but there is a set of serious, determined countries and leaders who recognize that we're now in a very, very different world to the one that we were just a few weeks ago. And the absolute imperative of standing up for Ukraine, standing up against Russia, being absolutely clear whose side we're on.
If the conversation needs to begin again, if the process needs to get back on track, what can help with that? Does Zelensky need a mediator? Is that what we're looking at now?
Trump, he's been a very famous person for a very long time, but he really made his name as a reality TV star. And he cannot stop playing that role. If he's serious about this being a peace deal, stop turning it into a daily episode about the peace deal. Do the work. So it's not about whether Zelensky needs a mediator. At some point, if this thing is going to get off the ground, then there will have to be further meetings between Trump and Zelensky, and eventually, possibly even with Putin at the table as well, and I hope Europe too. In the meantime, serious people have got to, on all sides, have got to talk to each other and try to get this show back on the road. I honestly think that the more this is played out as part of Trump's 24/7 media games to please the MAGA base, then the less chance there is of anybody actually making the sort of progress that needs to be made. And, you know, to be fair to Trump, he alluded to this, you know, sometimes things get said when people are very emotional, etc. Everybody just needs to calm down a bit, because all that happened yesterday, you can just imagine with the TV screens on in the Kremlin, can you imagine the Russians, how much they were laughing at what was going on? They were loving it. And that helps absolutely nobody.
Alistair Campbell on NewsHour. Coming up, a measles outbreak in the U.S. state of Texas again raises questions about the judgment of U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy.
He is preying on parents who are already worried and telling them that it is possible that terrible things will happen if they vaccinate their children, when in fact these vaccines have been proven over and over again to be safe and effective.
And our top story this hour, President Zelensky has insisted that he is thankful for U.S. support for Ukraine against Russia after an angry clash at the White House in which Donald Trump accused him of being ungrateful. Russian attacks in Ukraine are continuing to cause civilian casualties. Local officials say 6 people have been killed in the past day. And in other news, after decades of insurgency in Turkey, the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, has declared a ceasefire. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Let's turn to Turkey now, where the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, has declared an immediate ceasefire with Ankara. 2 days ago, the PKK's leader, Abdullah Öcalan, issued a statement from his prison cell urging the group he founded to end its 4-decade battle against the Turkish state and begin a process to dissolve itself. That's had a positive reception. Turkey's leader, President Erdogan, said it was a historic opportunity to end the insurgency, though the PKK's wider leadership says the process to disband the group must be led by Mr. Öcalan himself. Emberin Zaman is a Turkish journalist and chief correspondent for the Al Monitor News website. I asked her how important she thought this latest announcement from the PKK was.
It's an extremely important announcement, first of all, because it came so quickly. It responded instantly and unequivocally, saying that they would go along with Öcalan's call. But they set conditions for this. So the ball is now very much in Turkey's court. Turkey has to secure this environment so they can be sure that they won't be attacked.
First, just to look at Öcalan and his role in this. He's been in prison for the past 25 years. How does a man jailed for such a long time still hold so much influence over the organization that he created?
This is almost like a personality cult that's developed over the years. He's an extremely charismatic, an authoritarian figure who cast a spell over his followers. When he was captured, you had people actually setting themselves on fire, committing suicide. They were so upset. The PKK itself has determinedly cultivated, sustained this myth around Öcalan as the absolute leader of the movement, because this is the glue that's allowed them to keep things together.
To turn back to Turkey again, you said that the ball's now in Turkey's court. How might President Erdogan respond to all of this, to the announcement of a ceasefire? What considerations does he have?
Erdogan needs Kurdish support because under the constitution, he cannot run for a third time. The elections are due in 2028, and he'd like to make constitutional changes that would allow him to run. And for that, he needs Kurdish support. So he's reached out to the Kurds again, but he's not in the picture per se. Erdogan is kind of being very clever about this. If things go south, he can easily say, well, I had nothing to do with it.
Do you think that things could go south? What potential roadblocks could come up to stop this process, the potential end of a battle that has killed 40,000 people and displaced millions in southeastern Turkey?
It's going to be very tricky. Turkish public opinion may not be fully in favor of these negotiations. And we're talking about a time when the economy is really in very bad shape. The country is deeply polarized, and that's really also because the government has encouraged this polarization, criminalizing the Kurdish movement.
Just to round up, what about Kurdish groups, for example, in neighboring Syria? How do they fit into all of this?
Syria is very closely bound up with the PKK, because when the PKK began its fight, in fact, its leaders, including Öcalan, fled to Syria in the late 70s. And so that's where they were operating. People reckon that up to a third of their fighters are Syrian, because the Syrian Kurds chose not to fight the Assad regime and instead to consolidate their autonomy. Now, Turkey views that entity as an existential threat. It has, since 2016, been attacking Syrian Kurdish forces there, who, by the way, are the United States' top ally in the fight against the Islamic State And the fact that the US is partnered with them has kind of really blown a huge hole in the Turkish-US relationship. A big question now is whether Turkey will continue to attack those forces or not, and whether Öcalan's call extends to those forces or not. So lots of risks, but also quite a bit of hope, I would say.
Amber Inzaman, chief correspondent for Al Monitor. As Hollywood prepares for its biggest night of the year, Sunday's Oscars ceremony, oddsmakers are predicting that Anora, a dark fairy tale involving a sex worker in New York, stands a very good chance of taking home some top trophies. But it's not just the film that's getting attention. Its location, the Russian-speaking community of Brighton Beach in New York, is now witnessing an increase in tourism. Tom Brook went to Brighton Beach to meet Anora's location manager.
This story of Annie, a sex worker who marries the son of a Russian oligarch, a bittersweet tale of doomed romance, really highlights the New York Russian-speaking community of Brighton Beach, which lies 15 miles from Manhattan on the Atlantic Ocean. The film includes images from the cyclone, the iconic roller coaster in nearby Coney Island. There's also a memorable scene in a local Russian restaurant on the ocean boardwalk. And it features a huge multi-million dollar mansion where much of the film's action takes place. Ross Brodar was Anora's location manager. He found many of the places where the film was shot.
You take a look at Anora, and I think the locations are profoundly important. The mansion, Brighton Beach, the club where Annie works, they are a character in the story. And a lot of times a backdrop of a film informs you so much as to the life of the characters in the movie. Sean wanted to make sure that no matter what, we could get this block and be able to see the cyclone. And, you know, it's just famous Coney Island.
Anora is directed by Sean Baker, who grew up in nearby New Jersey. He is a very strong contender to win the Best Director trophy at the Oscars. Critics have praised him for the distinct style of his film. It has a great sense of place. He told me he credits location manager Ross Brodar with making that possible.
This film wouldn't be what it is without Ross. He got me literally every single location I wanted.
I'm waiting for you.
He secured the mansion.
Nice view.
He secured Tatiana's. He secured the wonderful candy shop that we shot at. I mean, literally, he got everything we needed.
Anora has many Russian-speaking characters, so Brighton Beach, with its large Russian-speaking community, worked perfectly as a location. Sean Baker had long been wanting to set a film in this New York neighborhood.
I was shooting a fashion film there in 2021. I looked around and I said, you know what? I have to set my next film here. It's just so beautiful.
Guys,
with Ross Brodar, I went to visit Tatiana, the Russian restaurant used in the picture.
Mushrooms, beef, cream, some onion, parsley. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Really good.
Over a beef stroganoff lunch, we looked at sequences from Anora shot at locations that Ross had found.
Watch this here.
He then showed me a scene that meant a lot to him.
I'm here for Mr. Zakharov.
Ivan?
In the film, he has a small part portraying a security guard.
That's your moment of glory, right?
I have a couple little moments of glory.
Did they mind you shooting here, or...?
No, they didn't mind at all.
Ross told me it meant a lot to work as part of the cast, albeit in a modest role.
I love being the location manager, but it's fun to be in the movie and have a few lines and do some work with the actors. I love acting as well. So, yeah, I was so appreciative that he threw me in there.
Anora has certainly brought images of New York's Brighton Beach community to an international audience, and people who live there are, for the most part, pleased that the film was shot in the neighborhood. For Ross Brodar, that Anora is making such a far-reaching impact means a lot.
To make a film on such a small budget and for it to resound so powerfully is a feat in of itself.
Ross Brodar, location manager for the film Anora, ending that report by Tom Brook. Anora, of course, is expected to take home some of the top awards at this Sunday's Oscars ceremony. Stay with us on NewsHour.
Japanese Chinese women are known for having tiny waistlines, and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To South Korea next, and the problem that for years politicians have described as a national emergency, the country's staggeringly low birth rate. Well, for the first time in 9 years, South Korea has just registered an uptick in births in 2024. It comes after a rise in marriages the year before. So how do we explain that rise? That's a question I put to Dr. Megan Hutchko, an obstetrician-gynecologist and director of the Center for Global Reproductive Health at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina.
Some of the rise, and it is a modest rise, is attributed to the fact that many marriages in Korea had been delayed during COVID. And so we're seeing an increase, a bump in the marriages over the past 2 years. And at the same time, there's a demographic bump among people in their early 30s, which is the most common age at first childbirth in Korea.
Does that mean you think that this corresponding rise in the birth rate is temporary? Or do you think we're seeing the start of a reversal in this long decline in the birth rate?
That's really hard to say. There have been these policies, which you could call pronatalist, since 2005. They've increased in number and in quality over the last few years. And in the second half of last year, they increased the duration of maternity leave. They increase the amount of childhood supplements. So there was some effort policy-wise. Many of those were not able to counteract some of the cultural and social and economic pressures.
Can you tell me more about those pressures that you mentioned? From what I understand, much of the decline in the birth rate has been attributed to South Korean women who are very well educated, often have quite good careers, and simply don't want to throw those things away after they have children when they're expected to stay in the home. Can we attribute the long decline to that?
Often when there are social, workplace, financial and economic pressures and overall difficulty in having children, the pressure or the blame does go on the women. But in South Korea, the vast majority of pregnancies occur within married couples. So I would challenge the paradigm of blaming women for the decreased fertility rate and say there are a lot of social pressures that don't allow families to financially sustain children. But certainly there is a lot of gendered pressure that puts much of the mental load or the family responsibility on women. Despite maternity leave policies, about one in five women who have kids in Korea don't go back to work. There are not a lot of policies that make that transition back to work easier for women. Some of the new policies that were introduced last year do increase the parental leave to include substantial time for fathers.
That was Dr. Megan Hutchko, an obstetrician-gynecologist and director of the Center for Global Health, Global Reproductive Health at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour coming to you on the BBC World Service. Let's go back to our top story, the political fallout from that explosive meeting between the U.S. and Ukrainian leaders in the White House yesterday. Let's return to that clash just to hear a short excerpt. The first voice you'll hear is Volodymyr Zelensky.
First of all, during the war, everybody has problems, even you, but you have nice ocean. And don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future.
You don't know that.
God bless. You will not have a war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
I'm not telling you.
Because you're in no position to dictate that. Remember this. You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. We're going to feel very good.
You will feel influence.
We're going to feel very good and very strong.
You will feel influence.
You're right now not in a very good position.
Well, Mr. Zelensky has now arrived in London and he's due to meet with the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. We're keeping an eye on the door of number 10 Downing Street as I speak. That's ahead of a summit of Ukraine's European allies in London on Sunday to discuss joint defence. So how are these developments, and particularly that meltdown in the Oval Office, being viewed by Russia? I'm joined now by Professor Nina Khrushcheva. She's a historian at the New School in New York and the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, who was the leader of the Soviet Union in the 1950s. And joining me from Washington, D.C. is Andrea Kendall-Taylor, who's senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the think tank, the Center for New American Security. Let me start with Professor Khrushcheva. Will Russia just press ahead with the war, do you think? Where is the pressure for Moscow to now engage in the peace process?
Well, thank you. Russia is, and that's what's been exchanges with the Trump administration, first the Putin-Trump phone call, and then already two meetings on a higher level between the Russians and the Americans, is that they are willing to engage with Trump in that peace offer that he seems to be proposing. We don't know exactly the details, but they seem to be favorable to Vladimir Putin. So they're fine with that. Just the question is, and that's exactly what Donald Trump said yesterday, is that I thought that, you know, we're questioning the Russians whether they want peace, but apparently we should be questioning Ukrainians. And that was a problem from the beginning, because in order to agree on peace, on one hand, it's fine to talk to them separately. On the other hand, you really need to know that they're ready to go with it. And so it seemed to me that yesterday in the White House, something went wrong, just because what the Trump didn't know, Trump people didn't know, that Vladimir Zelensky is not going to just take it lying down. So what happened to the protocol? I mean, it seemed like there was no protocol on either side. What happened to interpreters? Why would Vladimir Zelensky speak in English? Because that would have been much better expressed. Like, emotions would be out of this conversation, especially since you mentioned Nikita Khrushchev. He had interpreters and he was very bombastic guy. And so the interpreter often would calm down those emotions, would be better for diplomacy. So it seemed to me that it was just breakdown on every side. And of course, in the Kremlin, they're just looking at it and thinking, wow, that works great. And even we haven't even done anything to actually create this kind of explosion.
A view from Moscow there. Andrea Kendall-Taylor, Vladimir Putin, will he abide by any peace deal? Are Russia's long-term strategic ambitions unchanged after this meeting? Or is Russia thinking that Ukraine might now have to give more concessions now that the U.S. has had this, the Donald Trump has had this clash with Mr. Zelensky?
Well, I think that was the point that President Zelensky was trying to make in the Oval Office, which is that Russia often doesn't abide by the agreements that it makes. And so that was his warning to the Trump administration, that you can't simply be talking about a ceasefire without security guarantees, because in that case, the Russians will just use that as an opportunity to rest, re-equip, and retry. I think that the Kremlin's position has not changed. And if anything, its demands are growing. So as the Trump administration is really weakening Ukraine's leverage, taking things off the negotiating table, like Ukraine's NATO membership, like U.S. participation in a peacekeeping force, like inviting Russia to rejoin the G7, we're making all of these concessions, and there hasn't been any indication of any Russian concessions. And if anything, they appear to be growing, as they're saying that European forces can no longer be a part of the peacekeeping mission, etc. So I think bottom line, they haven't changed their position, and they still are looking to obtain those maximalist objectives that they had since day one of the
mission. Andrea, you also worked in the U.S. National Intelligence Council. In your view, can Trump still secure a peace deal with Russia on Ukraine?
To me, it looks increasingly unlikely, in large part because President Zelensky has been very clear that he is not willing to accept a deal that's forced down Ukraine's throat. And granted, without the United States in the equation, it does weaken Ukraine. Ukraine's position, they would be certainly better off with U.S. support. But when you look at what they get from the United States, it's just about 20% of the military aid, while Ukraine's own industrial production and European support also comprises a large part. So to me, it doesn't look likely at this point in time, as the Ukrainians and the Europeans seem intent on fighting until they can get to a position with security guarantees that would give Ukraine the security it needs to stop fighting, knowing that the war won't simply resume.
And Nina Khrushcheva, I'll give the last question over to you. So from a similar point of view, you know, Russia has now said Mr. Zelensky's trip to the U.S. was a complete failure. What do you think this means for any potential deal with Ukraine?
Well, from the deal point of view, was certainly a failure. And even it's not just the Russians, but even some press and some analysts in Ukraine were saying that perhaps as much as it is very, very brave of Zelensky to stand up to Trump, what does it mean for Ukraine in general, for the continuation of the war? Because yes, Europe is going to stand by Ukraine. They're meeting in London. But can they actually deliver that standing up to Ukraine, with Ukraine, when the United States is not involved? And so that is a big question that we don't have an answer to yet, how much Europe is going to be putting more effort forward, not less, and whether it will be a time in a near future when we're still alive, when Ukraine would strengthen its position. Because let's be honest, in the last 2 years, Ukraine has not improved its position on the battlefield. And there is still a question what the actual plan is, how it's going to do that, while its resources are dwindling, this people, it doesn't have enough people and whatnot. And I think that's a big question for the meetings in Europe. If they do plan to stand by Ukraine, with Ukraine, the way they say they are and they have been and they say they will be.
Okay. Thank you very much to you both. That was Nina Khrushcheva, historian at the New School in New York, and Andrea Kendall-Taylor, senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Well, big protests are underway in the Romanian capital today. Tens of thousands of people are marching through the center of Bucharest in support of Călin Ceaușescu, the anti-globalist candidate who came first in last November's presidential election, which was subsequently annulled. Mr. Ceaușescu was also briefly detained, and charges against him include membership of a neo-fascist organization. The BBC's Central Europe correspondent Nick Thorpe joins us now live from the protests. Nick, tell us who's protesting and why.
Yeah, well, Celia, it's a very big demonstration, a very peaceful, well-natured, but very loud one as well. It's a sea of Romanian tricolour flags I can see in front of me here in Piazza Victoriei. That's in front of the government building. The people have just marched through the centre of Bucharest. These are strong supporters of Călin Georgescu. They see him as their candidate. They're very angry that the last presidential election, the first round of it, was cancelled by the courts. They're angry about the charges against him. People I've spoken to in the crowd describe those charges as ridiculous. Basically, this is a nationalist demonstration in favour of a nationalist, anti-globalist leader. And they say that they're against what they call the corruption of the past 30 or so years in Romania since the revolution. So, you know, many emotions here, very strong emotions and a strong backing for a man who's clearly now in the crosshairs of the Romanian judicial system.
Now, tell us more about Mr. Ceaușescu, if you can. You know, we were describing him as anti-globalist. Can you tell us more about his views?
Sure, yeah. I mean, he's an interesting figure, a sort of maverick figure, if you like, who was little known in Romania. He didn't come from nowhere, but he was little known in Romania in the past. So he's a figure who says that he says he doesn't want to take Romania out of the EU or NATO, which are actually quite popular in Romania, but he does want Romanian sovereignty to be put first, as he puts it. I think he and certainly his supporters here in the crowd feel that Romania has almost been something like a servant in the EU It hasn't pulled its weight in the EU. They're pretty critical of Romania's support for Ukraine in the war. They don't see Russia as such a threat to European peace as, shall we say, people on the centre or the left of European politics do. They're resentful of the amount of support which Romania has given to refugees. They say they're this is a poor country and should be basically helping its own people. That's an amalgam of the views of some of the people I've spoken to here today.
And just to look at how this is being viewed from the United States, in his speech at the Munich Security Conference, the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance twice criticized the annulment of that first round of Romania's presidential elections. Can you tell us more about the reaction stateside to the arrest of Mr. Georgescu?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Georgescu, it was pretty astonishing in that speech by the U.S. vice president. As you say, he mentioned Romania twice. He only mentioned Ukraine twice in the same speech. So it was a measure, I suppose, of this support coming from Washington now, from the new Trump administration, for right-wing or far-right parties, candidates in Europe. We saw this with the support from Elon Musk and the Trump administration for the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, in the recent elections in Germany. Now we're seeing it, or we have been hearing it, from the Trump administration for Mr. Georgescu here. So it is part of this astonishing realignment of global politics with the most powerful state in the world, the United States, now backing...
Nick, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We'll let you get back to the protests. That was the BBC Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. An unvaccinated child in Texas died this week from measles, the first fatality from the highly contagious disease in the United States since 2015. Since the beginning of the year, more than 130 cases have been identified in western Texas and neighboring New Mexico State. Officials say most cases are children and teenagers who are either unvaccinated or had an unknown vaccinated status. The U.S. Health Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. has described the outbreak as not unusual, which has angered many health professionals. Among them is Kim Schrier, a pediatrician and a Democratic congresswoman. She blames Robert Kennedy for the outbreak.
I am very clearly saying that he has had a loud platform. And so he has been one of the main people spreading disinformation and doubt about vaccines, along with others. He's certainly not the only one, but he is preying on parents who are already worried and telling them that it is possible that terrible things will happen if they vaccinate their children, when in fact, these vaccines have been proven over and over again to be safe and effective.
Well, let's get more on this from Peter Hotez, a pediatrician and co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Hotez, can you tell us briefly about this particular measles outbreak in Texas? Is it spreading?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite a large epidemic. Their official numbers are around 146 children and adults, both in West Texas and across the border into New Mexico. But the actual numbers, from what I'm hearing from people on the ground, is actually probably hundreds, because many are still in the process of getting diagnosed or not even getting medical attention. And it's not just the number of infections. It's at least 20 hospitalizations so far with measles pneumonia, another measles complication, and of course that horrific tragedy of one completely unnecessary death among a school-aged child who was denied access to the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And we're still at the early stages, I think. I think this is continuing to accelerate. So this is going to be a major undertaking for us.
Can you tell us more about measles? Is it unusual to have a measles outbreak? Or is it usual, I should say, to have a measles outbreak, like JFK Jr. said on Wednesday?
It hasn't been up until recently. So we in the United States, we eliminated measles as a public health problem in the year 2000, 25 years ago. But in Texas especially, we have a very aggressive anti-vaccine lobby that works on legislation to make it easier for parents to opt out of immunizing their children for school entry and for school attendance, and convincing parents that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is somehow dangerous or can lead to autism, which is all complete nonsense, and also downplays the severity of measles itself and neglects to tell parents that 20% of children who acquire measles require hospitalization for all of the complications, including measles pneumonia, dehydration from diarrhea, measles encephalitis, deafness, permanent neurological injury. They forget conveniently to tell parents that measles is a bad actor.
And Dr. Otez, I should say I misspoke. I said JFK. Obviously, I meant RFK, Robert Kennedy Jr., the health secretary. We have a brief amount of time left, but just briefly, where do you think we should go from here? You talked about the need to convince parents of this risk.
That's right. So, I mean, clearly stepping up our health education is going to be paramount. But also, we need to do something about our anti-vaccine lobby here in Texas, because they dominate the internet and they're so aggressive. And countering that disinformation is going to be really important to make parents better understand. And remember, even though we're talking about measles today, it's not only measles. We're seeing in the United States a 5 to 6-fold rise in pertussis cases, whooping cough cases. We've had polio in the wastewater. We're going the wrong direction, and the anti-vaccine activism that accelerated during COVID, my estimates are 200,000 Americans needlessly perished because they refused a COVID vaccine in 2021 and 2022, is now spilling over into all childhood immunizations. And the tip of the spear is in Texas, because we have the most aggressive anti-vaccine lobby.
Dr. Otez, this is
a national problem.
Dr. Otez, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Dr. Peter Otez, pediatrician and co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. As Western tourists are being allowed into North Korea for the first time in more than 5 years, the first British tourists have told the BBC they were surprised by both the level of control and the poverty they experienced. The country sealed its borders at the start of the pandemic in 2020. Since then, it's isolated itself further, relying on support from Russia and China. Some doubted whether Westerners would ever be allowed back in. More from Gene McKenzie in South Korea.
This is a bottle of rattlesnake, a bottle of North Korean rattlesnake whiskey.
No surprise that it was YouTubers and travel addicts who rushed to be the first into North Korea when it rather suddenly opened its doors last week. As usual, the tourists had to stick to a pre-approved itinerary and were escorted at all times by local guides, something that unnerved this British travel blogger, Mike O'Kennedy.
I've never experienced that kind of level of control. There were times where I had to like let them know I was just going to the bathroom.
Hi everybody.
Excellent.
On the agenda were carefully curated trips to factories and schools. This was the jaw-dropping moment of the trip, a performance by 8-year-old schoolchildren singing and dancing in front of animations of exploding ballistic missiles. Despite the chaperoning, the tourists were able to get glimpses of the poverty the state tries so hard to hide. The roads were terrible and there was no heating, apart from in their hotel, said Joe Smith, who was on his third trip to North Korea.
The hotel room was, yeah, pretty filthy. And like I say, the cockroaches and stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love it all. It's all part of the North Korean experience. But it's like, if that's the best they can show these tourists, then I kind of also dread to think about what else is out there, to be honest.
Western tourists have been allowed back in before aid workers and many Western diplomats, including the British, as Kim Jong-un shuns the West and leans instead on Vladimir Putin, supporting his war in Ukraine. These trips are contentious. They might give some North Koreans a rare chance to learn from foreigners, but critics argue they only really benefit the regime.
Jean McKenzie. I'm Celia Hatton. We've come to the end of this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for joining us.
Japanese women are known for having tiny waistlines, and one in five young women there are underweight. But Japan's most followed comedian, Naomi Watanabe, is shaking things up. I'm Hannah Gelbart, and I've been chatting to her about how she is breaking Japanese body image norms and adapting to life in the Big Apple. You can listen to our conversation on What in the World, a daily podcast that explains what's happening in the world every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.